To flee or not to flee. All the time while I was doing my show on a different channel and fighting all those fuckers that sucked up to the regime and facing public rage, I had forgotten that I was in the middle of a legal battle. When the first channel, CBC, banned my show a year earlier, we went to court to settle that dispute through an arbitration case. Meanwhile, I went to host my final season on NBC until I was banned again, but this time under friendlier conditions, in which the network and the show had mutually consented to end things peacefully. All that time the arbitration case with CBC was going on, this was a commercial arbitration case, so basically it was a game of numbers and figures to decide who breached the contract and who hurt the other party financially. With my limited understanding of the law, that was what I thought. Well, I thought wrong. The final verdict was overdue. Since I had started traveling to Europe and the States to do speaking engagements, the verdict had been delayed and rescheduled more than 3 times. After my speech in Oslo, I was invited to speak in the United States for a number of events. My return to Egypt was to be on the 10th of November. The verdict was delayed further to be announced on the 11th. I landed in Cairo on the 10th around midnight and slept. The next day, I woke to Tarek's phone call. He was still a fugitive in Dubai, asking me to be on a conference Skype call in our company's headquarters in Cairo in an hour. Bassem, it is important. We need you there. I can't speak on the phone. So I went to the company with absolutely no clue what was going on. I walked into a room full of long faces, the members of the board, the CFO, the media representative, the operational manager, and Tarek was on the other side of the call. Bassem, we lost the arbitration, they told me as I went in. They slammed us with a £100 million fine, and you are obligated to pay half. The verdict was so skewed that it held me accountable to pay the whole lot if the company defaulted. How could we lose? I asked. Bassem, it was out of our hands. This verdict was manipulated. It was totally politicized, the lawyer told me. They handed me a page of the verdict that discussed the importance of national pride and how the country should get together to face the imminent dangers, and how satirical shows are only fit for advanced countries, but in countries like us, such shows are counterproductive and may cause public unrest and disrupt the peace. This was no legal verdict. This was no arbitration decision. This was a page of cheap propaganda. Not only was the verdict unprofessional, but it was an insult to Egyptians in suggesting that we are not mature enough to take a joke. Bassem, you need to leave the country right now, Sharif, our CFO, told me. We have taken the liberty to book you a flight to Dubai to be with Tarek. I don't think it is safe for you here. But could they arrest me? I asked. Listen, the lawyer told me, under the law and under normal conditions, they cannot arrest you or put you on a no-fly list. They can confiscate your assets and that's it. However, with all the craziness happening here, they can arrest you or at least prevent you from traveling under a heavy cover of propaganda. No one will ask complex legal questions. For the masses, you are now a convict, and the law should be respected. Your flight is in 4 hours. I suggest you pack, Sharif said abruptly. For the next 4 hours, I was in a state of shock. I can't even remember what I did and how I did it. I stopped by my dad's to tell him I was fleeing the country. He also was in shock, but I only had a few minutes for a final goodbye. There was no time to see my brother, so I told Dad to fill him in. Just like that, the time with my father was over. I went back home and asked my wife to help me pack whatever I could get into 2 suitcases. I had to explain to her what was happening while I frantically threw stuff into my suitcases. It was a terrible feeling. Why should I be the one escaping in the middle of the night, like a drug dealer or a corrupt politician? All I did was make jokes. My wife was unusually calm. She was just too cool for all of what was happening. When I asked her about this, she said, "Well, at least you are not being arrested or shot. Many of the people we know now are in prison, or even shot in the middle of a demonstration. Traveling is temporary. I can deal with that. Sometimes you remember all the awesome reasons that made you fall in love with your wife. That was one of those moments. Are you sure you didn't forget anything? She asked me as I was rushing out the door. With that frantic packing, I am dead sure I forgot a lot, I answered jokingly. Thank God my 3-year-old daughter was too young to understand all of this. Abbas, my old friend, came with me to the airport. He wanted to be there to ask for assistance in case I was arrested. Was my name already on the list? Would they let me fly? I didn't know what to expect. The verdict had come out only a few hours earlier. Remember how I started this story, this book? Me in a car wondering if I would be able to get on that plane? Well, by the grace of some benevolent being, I got on it. I headed to Dubai. When I landed there, social media was already buzzing about the verdict. The usual propaganda websites and state-run networks were describing me as a fugitive who had escaped a legal verdict. A regular comic on the run. Watching the craziness from a distance. In the 2 years since I left Egypt, things haven't gotten better. Thousands of people had been incarcerated for the most trivial reasons. Hundreds have been tortured on a daily basis in police stations. Others have been killed. You would think that there would be some sort of stability on the surface at least. You know, the kind of fake stability military dictatorship have. But even economically, the army was running the country into the ground. They were basically milking the shit out of it, changing laws, basking in the corruption that is protected by their military status. Every day, people woke up to a new business taken by the army. The regime was telling us that no matter what happens, we are still better than Syria and Iraq. That was the new boogeyman now. But we were actually turning into Syria or Iraq without any outside military interference or an inside civil war. The military supporters still lack any thoughts resembling logic. They are part of the same echo chamber you'd find yourself in if you attended a Trump rally. Everyone is conspiring against us. They are out to get us. They hate us for our freedoms. Even when Sisi visited Germany and the media there grilled him for all the human rights violations, Egyptian media accused the German media of being funded by Islamists. Fascism was coveted and promoted like never before, in the same way that white supremacy and racism and bullying were normalized for Trump supporters. Many media figures accompanied the president to China. They came back marveling at how strong China is. China was doing just fine with no democracy, they said. They even shut down social media and Facebook and YouTube. They don't need it there. We should do the same. In Egypt, North Korea was not a joke. It was an example to follow. In one incident, an Egyptian judge sentenced more than 500 people to death in less than 20 minutes. They were all accused of killing one police officer. One. Young people were taken from their houses in the middle of the night and disappeared for months. They then appeared in a propaganda video produced by the military in which they confessed to taking part in terrorist plots, and pictures were taken of them with a variety of weapons as though they were being photographed for a spread of a monthly publication of Terrorism Today. They were later filmed confessing to their evil deeds. Many of their families came out and said that those confessions were tortured out of them. You didn't even have to participate in a political activity to be taken into custody. A 22-year-old college student was arrested for photoshopping Mickey Mouse ears onto Sisi's head. They looked really good on him. Still, that kid was sentenced to 3 years in jail. Army generals appeared on television to claim there is a Supreme Council of the world that controls everything, that decides which country they want to bring down. Sisi warned Egyptians that we are facing a fourth-generation war, whatever the hell that means, and hinted that those who opposed his rule were spies or were affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. The media were creating a new breed of citizens. We were now a nation of informants. Border control officers in Cairo Airport bragged about their catch of the day, on the pages of newspapers. That catch could be little remote-control helicopters and drone toys, you know, those toys being sold at Brookstone. The photos appeared under a headline saying, "Border Control Exposes a Devious Plot to Smuggle Spy Drones into the Country." The paranoia spread like wildfire among regular Egyptians. All they heard on television was that there was a global conspiracy against Egypt, so it is only natural that they would go out into the streets seeking to save their country. English once again became a dangerous language to speak in public. A British couple was captured and delivered to the police by concerned citizens in the subway who had overheard the two talking in their own language, you know, English. You see, America, you are not the only country to throw people off planes for speaking another language. I still had a share of accusations directed at me too. Although I was thousands of miles away from Egypt, the media hitmen were all over my case. They would refer to me as the American poster child. One TV host said, "America always takes care of its men in Egypt, and Bassem Youssef is living proof of that." Madness is now everywhere. It is the kind that makes people believe anything out of fear and hysteria. Like that time the army told the Egyptian people that they had defeated the American Sixth Fleet. "That's right. We defeated your troops in a war you never knew anything about." One of the famous pro-military TV hosts appeared on his show holding a copy of Hillary Clinton's memoir, Hard Choices. He announced that, according to this book, America tried to send the Sixth Fleet to invade Egypt and reinstate Morsi. However, the Egyptian army under Sisi prevented this invasion and even managed to capture the commander of the Sixth Fleet through a special operation. "We threatened that we would expose America's defeat to the world if they didn't retreat, which they did. And that would have been so, so, so cool if only it had happened." The TV anchor actually had an easy time getting away with this by citing Clinton's book, because not a single person has read that book. Have you read that book? I haven't. Literally, no one. Everyone was living in a parallel reality. But something had to give. Everything in the country was falling apart. The economy was going down the drain. Prices were rising by the minute. Many were starting to see this regime for what it really is, a failure. But the military wouldn't accept that. In their book, and the book of their staunch supporters, the country was fine. When they ran out of tricks and people started to really feel the hardship with the worsening economy, the police announced that they had arrested 12 people who they accused of plotting to spread a pessimistic mood in the country. According to the government, there were no shortages of goods, no devaluation of currency, and no collapse in services and infrastructure. It was all an illusion propagated by 12 traitors. As usual, they had people on camera confessing, probably out of fear of torture, that they had plotted to spread rumors daily to destroy the morale of the public. You might ask yourself, how come the supporters of such a regime don't see all of this? Well, the military always had an explanation for everything, even for the most absurd things. They would believe the military no matter what happened, even if the military's lies were exposed. I will give you an example. In the fall of 2015, the military proudly announced that they had a successful airstrike, killing a terrorist cell in the Egyptian western desert. This was a common occurrence. Some people would be killed somewhere, and the military or the police would simply say they were terrorists. There was no other source than the military, and no one dared to question that. After all, the people killed in these raids or attacks are Egyptians, who are worth nothing to the regime. Everything was justified by national security. But this time, those who were killed in the airstrike turned out to be Mexican tourists who were on an off-road trip. Since there was a foreign government involved, they couldn't say that those people were just some terrorists. The Mexican foreign minister flew to Egypt to deliver a very harsh message to Sisi for this fuck-up. What happened then was absolutely ridiculous, as Sisi was photographed with the Mexican minister with his face showing that he was shitting in his pants. The Egyptian media pushed the narrative that Mexicans are known to be drug dealers, and those who were killed must have been there illegally. Even after the military's initial lie about the victims being terrorists was exposed, the military supporters just believed the new narrative that we killed a bunch of drug dealers. Mexicans being drug lords? Supporters who would believe anything? Why is this so familiar? Oh yes, the Trump wagon. When I came to America, I witnessed all of Trump's scandals, including the famous tape in which he was bragging about grabbing women by the pussy. I saw a Trump supporter listening to the tape and saying that she still supported Trump. He had been chosen by Jesus to save America. No matter what Trump or Sisi does, their supporters will never change their position. Stupidity is not exclusive to the Middle East. I was watching all of this and thanking God I didn't have my show. I would have had endless material, but every joke I would have had to make would have brought me closer to jail. And yet, they asked me to come back. The intelligence service contacted me this go-around. What a shocker. My own little curse. It was early 2015, 3 months after I escaped the country, and I was watching the lunacy that is the Egyptian media and regime from Dubai. I was still there trying to make ends meet. Dubai isn't the cheapest city in the world, and I was slammed with legal fees fighting that stupid verdict to prevent the authorities from confiscating my belongings in Egypt. The funny thing was that I was struggling financially while huge contracts were thrown my way. I was offered the slot as host for SNL Arabia in the Middle East under one condition: no political satire. I was living a paradox of struggling financially while refusing multi-million dollar deals for light comedy shows and offers for game shows. Hell, I was even asked to be a judge on the Arab X Factor. Al-Bernamig was my blessing and my curse. I knew that if I were on screen, people would expect me to talk about the political madness and not politely joke about some trivial celebrity gossip or fluff piece. Many accuse me of selling out and not continuing the show abroad. I have seen people follow the fervor pushing them to do more, who ended up in jail, and all they got was a hashtag for their name. People will dare you to fight their battles, but in the end, you will find yourself alone. I received yet more devastating news. My dad was hit by a car in Cairo. He died immediately. After years of dealing with death within this revolution, I was numb. I actually saw my dad's death as a blessing, a way to take a rest from this maddening world. A break from the zombie land Egypt has become. My dad belonged to that older generation that yearned for stability. A military dictatorship for them is better than the uncertainty and the chaos that a revolution brings. My dad and I had our arguments, but they were far less heated than the ones I had with my mom. They were always sold by a couple of free tickets for the show. In less than 18 months, I lost both of my parents. This might have been a sign. Maybe it was better to break whatever ties I still had with the place I used to call home. Maybe it was my parents bidding me farewell and asking me to look forward instead of looking back at the past. My parents left this life healthy, strong, and independent. How many people can say that? They were the best parents. They carried my burden all their lives. And when they left easily and swiftly and without burdening others. I wanted to go back and bury my father, but I was afraid of being arrested upon arrival. My brother urged me not to come back. I had to comply, but couldn't help but feel guilty. Only a few months earlier, a friend of mine, an activist, was arrested on arrival because he had come back to visit his sick mom. Egypt for me had turned into Hotel California. You could check in any time you like, but you can never leave. We are sorry. We want you back. Over the nine-month period since I had left Egypt, I was approached 3 times by the Egyptian intelligence service urging me to come back. I would get a call or request to meet people connected to the intelligence service, telling me that they were authorized to find out if there was a possibility for me to come back to Egypt. This has been a strategy all too familiar in Egypt. Get a hold of the dissidents and give them a spot to show the world that the regime is democratic. But bit by bit, this dissident will be tamed and eventually controlled. Here we are, back to the dog analogy. When I was fighting with my previous channel, a famous anchor with the channel called me and asked me to take it easy. "We all know that you are right to speak up," he told me. "But sometimes, when the wind is too strong, you need to bend down. We need to stay in the game, to push forward other issues. We can't solve everything at once." This guy had been on the airwaves for more than 15 years. He represented everything I hated about media in the Arab world. "Well, with all due respect," I answered, "when you bend down once, you stay bent. You never stand tall again. You have been around for too long not to know that." I wonder why he stopped calling. Time after time, the intelligence service sent their people to talk to me. By then, the huge popularity of Sisi was slipping. The economy was going to the crapper, and even the rich, well-to-do people were getting fed up with everything. Their media tools were losing their credibility fast, and the regime needed a facelift. They realized that the way they dealt with you was wrong. "They are willing to give you whatever guarantees you need," the mediators told me. I asked them if I would have absolute freedom with my content, and they answered that there should be some sort of understanding and that we all needed to work for the good of the country. The understanding would basically mean that I would be appointed some officer looking over my script, and the good of the country would be a thick black marker. I didn't trust them. I knew they would use me to whitewash their tyrannical acts. The last time they approached me, I had had enough. I told the caller that if the regime didn't intend to release the people in jail and ask other journalists and activists who fled the country to come back, in addition to starting a real investigation into their human rights violations, they should just go fuck themselves. I didn't hold back with the Sisi bashing either. The guy on the phone was appalled at the number of the F-words I threw his way. I knew my calls were monitored, and I didn't care. I wanted them to hear it. I knew they wanted me on air again, under their control, totally castrated. They wanted to show the world that, hey, your Egyptian John Stewart is back. I was their decoy. I couldn't do that, not because I was a freedom fighter, or God forbid, I had a conscience or even principles. No, I refuse because when a satirist is not allowed to speak freely about what matters to the people, he ceases to be a satirist. He becomes a mere distraction. Many comedy shows launched after my show ended. All were simple, safe social comedies, where they totally ignored the disaster that is Sisi and just focused on making fun of the citizens. I couldn't do that. I would have lost whatever self-respect I still had. Since I didn't have a regular show at the time, I put together a one-man show. It was a mix of a stand-up, storytelling, and a think piece to reflect on the madness of the media during the Arab Spring. I would satirize the media during the Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Sisi eras. The shows were all a great success, but there was one problem. The intelligence service sent people to heckle me and try to spoil the show. This was a page right out of the book of the former Soviet Union propaganda machine. Intelligence used the same people to hold rallies for Sisi whenever he visited Western capitals. I was warned of this before I got on stage. The heckler's aim was to get a 30-second bite on camera. One would call me names or shout at me and try to get a reaction, while another would covertly shoot their whole thing on his phone. Knowing this beforehand, I maintained my composure. And I even made fun of them, turning them into the laughingstock of the theater. But it didn't matter. The video made it to the state-run media, and I looked as if I was about to be kicked out by the audience. Headlines like, "Egyptians reject Bassem Youssef jokes against Sisi," or "Bassem Youssef evicted from a show because of angry audience," made it into Egyptian newspapers. As per usual, the truth didn't matter really. It was all for the propaganda. I couldn't believe that a regime with all of its resources had turned into sulking middle school crybabies who just wanted to get back at people they didn't like. I didn't feel safe in the Middle East anymore. I decided to take my toxic brand elsewhere. I saw that a certain country was experiencing its own version of hate, xenophobia, and fascism. Maybe not as widespread as in Egypt, but they were getting there. So I packed my bags and decided to move to America. America, a different kind of crazy. I received an offer from Fusion Television, a part of a bigger network that includes Univision and The Onion. I asked them if they were serious or if it was a stunt for The Onion fake news. They were more than serious. They wanted me to host a show that satirizes American politics from a Middle Eastern perspective. The show would be called Democracy Handbook. I got to travel around America, attend Trump rallies, the Republican and the Democratic National Conventions, and the like. It was such a fun experience to see the American democracy at work. But as I was inside the Republican convention, it was deja vu for me, listening to Trump, Gingrich, Giuliani, and the rest of the who's who of who the hell are those people taking the stage one after the other gave me the jitters. I would sometimes translate parts of their speeches in my head, and they would sound exactly the same as the ones I heard back home. The fear, the xenophobia, the hate. They all came in different shapes and forms. Only they were wearing more expensive suits and had much pastier skin. When I heard that many Americans, like many Egyptians, believe that Obama is a secret Muslim Brotherhood member, I never thought I would actually meet those people in real life. I interviewed people at Trump rallies who believe that there are at least 35 to 40 ISIS training camps inside the United States, all sanctioned by the black Muslim president. The stupidity was not limited to some fringe supporters. On Fox News, I found an abundance of stupidity and ignorance. I discovered the simplistic way Americans look at the Middle East, and I get asked a lot if it is better to have a military or an Islamic government in Egypt. But people don't realize that it is just one and the same. Many think that it is better to have a military dictator in the Middle East to protect against fundamentalists. The thing is, military regimes in the Middle East are fundamentalists. The way they use the religious groups and the Salafi sheikhs to keep people under control is in and of itself one of their strongest weapons. The way they use Al-Azhar Mosque, our own version of the Vatican, and the Coptic Church to curb people's rights to speak freely is no different from what the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to do. One used a gun to get to power, then protects it with religion, and one used religion to get to power, then protects it with the gun. Under religious regimes, when things go really badly, people start to ask why God isn't helping them now that they are pious and religious. I mean, isn't Islam the solution for everything? When that happens, the religious authorities tell the people that it's their own fault, that they are not religious enough, and that this is a test from God that we need to overcome. It's the same under the military rule. When Sisi's regime destroyed the Egyptian economy, and when people started to scrape for food, TV anchors with their fat paychecks told people that it was their own fault because they were asking for too much. It is not the time to ask for three whole meals now, one anchor said. The country is in a critical situation, and you should consider the worsening economic conditions as a test from God. Don't you have enough faith? The tricks are the same. The bullshit is the same. Many Americans ask me, what can we do in the Middle East? How can we help? This is not an easy question to answer. And remember, this is not a book with real solutions. I'm a satirist at the end of the day, and I'm not capable of giving you a fancy solution loaded with political jargon. But I can tell you that whatever America is doing, it's not working. The West is in love with this idea of dealing with one entity that can guarantee stability. Whether this entity is a military regime, a strong Islamic political group, or a monarchy that uses religion to control its people, America supports those regimes for the fake promise of stability and to guarantee its own interests. But this stability comes with a price. For these regimes, stability means the elimination of any form of free speech. The Middle East has been a dangerous place to ask any questions about religion or the military for the past 60 years. If you ask questions, you are either a traitor, an infidel, or both. It's like that Salafi who couldn't handle my questioning on how Sharia is not compatible with modern life, or the pro-military people who couldn't imagine that the army could lie to them about that AIDS cure. Fact-checking the authorities is looked upon as a form of mutiny against the country or against God. They will always find a way to justify ridiculous claims. If you challenge those claims, you don't like the country, or you are misinformed by mainstream media, which is not telling you the truth. When I see Trump making things up, like claiming that Obama created ISIS and people believe him, and even claim that the media are covering it up, it is no different from what I saw at home. Whenever his supporters were faced with facts and reality, they would simply tell you that this is the talk of liberal media who hate Trump and who hate America. Same as with military supporters in Egypt. Whenever you give them a glimpse of how the real world outside views our regime as a pathetic joke, they immediately tell you that it's just part of a global conspiracy against Egypt. This is a result of continuous infusion of hate, but before you hate, you first need to fear. And this is what all these regimes in the Middle East, or even Trump in America, or those pro-Brexit politicians in Britain are so good at. Fear has always been their best weapon. Fear of refugees, of people who don't look like us, fear of losing our religion and identity, fear of war and the destruction that will happen if you don't blindly follow your dictator, or simply the fear arising from dealing with facts, reality, and science, because truth is not really their friend. Satire is a great antidote to that fear mentality. When you laugh, you are not afraid anymore. Dictators are afraid of jokers. Laughing in the face of tyranny and fear disarms them in front of their supporters. Ridiculing them, making fun of them, and questioning their empty rhetoric exposes them and sends them running naked through the streets. They come back at you with all their might because it is much more than their image or dignity that they want to preserve. Their legitimacy is at stake. That's why they try to belittle you, bring you down, and destroy your image in front of their supporters. They will call you a clown, a fool, a joke, but in the process, they are the ones who end up looking like clowns, they are the ones making fools out of themselves, and they are the ones turning into one big fat joke. The irony of satire is that anyone who takes it too seriously automatically turns into the very clown they think they are fighting against. So why do we have to go through this? Will a revolution ever work? That might be a bit more difficult than we thought, for one very good reason: money. Do revolutions really work? From Tahrir to Occupy Wall Street, a bullshit analysis. You had your own version of a little revolution when a bunch of young adults did a Tahrir-style sit-in at Wall Street. For a country that touts its freedoms and right to assembly, how did that go? Free speech in America is a lovely thing, but can it alone change the monopoly of the banks and the corruption of big business and their strong lobbies in Congress? Many are starting to recognize that American democracy is actually changing into an oligarchy. People are vocal about all the imperfections of the system, and yet free speech alone might not even leave a dent in the problem, let alone fix it. When people get more physical, they get crushed by the militarization of their own police. That's why the Occupy movement was looked upon as a bunch of crazy hippies who wanted to disrupt the system. Well, isn't a revolution, by definition, disruption of the system? You might ask, what does this have to do with the Egyptian revolution? Well, there are actually quite a few similarities. The revolution came to disrupt many interests. After 60 years of military rule, soldiers get too relaxed and found other battles to fight, like the ultimate battle to fill their bank accounts. In Egypt, over the past few decades, the army became more of a private corporation. The details of their budget are kept secret. They control a huge chunk of the economy, including the monopolization of many industries. Considering they don't pay taxes, customs, utilities, transportation costs, and even no decent salaries, since the soldiers are forcibly drafted and work as slaves in their factories, there is a huge amount of money filling their coffers. The army in Egypt owns everything. They own the land, they own the resources, and they own the power to destroy your business if they want. Over the past few years, they went into all kinds of businesses, from construction to retail to mining. Nothing was off limits to the money-hungry generals. They even have their own hotels, bakeries, and beauty centers. It is not uncommon to see a sign reading, "The armed forces welcome you. Special rates today on Brazilian waxing." In 2016, the army announced the opening of its first ever private international middle and high school. The headmistress of the school said in an interview that although the school adopts the American educational system, she still believes that an American conspiracy is targeting Egypt. There is a fortune teller in America whose prophecies all come true. He predicted that in one of the Arab countries, Egypt, there would be a president who pretends to represent Islam, Morsi, though he is far from it, and that the president who comes next would unite the Arab region and destroy the American economy. That president will have a name made up of two repeated syllables. He means Sisi. When I openly talked about the army's economy on Facebook, all hell broke loose. Every single media outlet was out there to get me. There was even a television poll asking people if I should be put on military trial for treason and executed. Well, that's a comforting thought. I was a threat to them even when I was in exile and not active in Arab media. The military didn't mind having the Islamists come to power. As a matter of fact, the Muslim Brotherhood, during their honeymoon period with the military, were after anyone who remotely criticized the military. They were the perfect conservatives and religious shield for the military's interests. It was only when the Brotherhood wanted a bigger piece of the pie that the generals got pissed. A revolution is not just about freedom of speech, but the ability to monitor authority and hold it accountable. When a revolution fails, whether in Tahrir Square or Wall Street, it's always because someone doesn't want to get caught. It is imperative that they keep their privilege of milking the goods of the country any way possible. You have a more chic way of affecting the outcome of elections and rigging political control. You have lobbies, complex interest groups, gerrymandering, and Citizens United. For us, that convoluted system is too costly, so we use religion, fake patriotism, and plain brutal force and oppression. We have no time to hypnotize people with sports, sex, and entertainment, and our leaders are too proud to give a margin of freedom so people can blow off steam and criticize them. When I think of the military junta that controls the country now, I don't think of them as generals or army officers who just want absolute power. I think of them as a bunch of businessmen in military uniform who will protect their economic interests with tanks and machine guns. As with most any corporate or government fiasco, follow the money trail and you'll find the greedy turd sandwich causing all the problems. Of course, there are other reasons for failing revolutions and why dictatorship is a chronic disease in the Middle East. There are social, religious, sectarian, historical, and political reasons for that. But this is not that kind of book. For deeper and more accurate analysis, go get one of those boring books published by Washington think tanks or political science departments in fancy Ivy League universities. I don't have the credentials or even the desire to be that deep. Now, let's finish this goddamn book and try to leave you with a word of wisdom or something. The Middle East does not have nine lives. Just when I thought I'd left the madness behind me, I came to America to find the orange menace taking over your country. Is it me? Am I bringing bad luck everywhere I go? Am I a dictator magnet? My wife was sitting next to me as we watched Trump win. She looked at me with this incriminating stare, as if she was asking me, "Is this what you brought me to?" Right between us was Nadia, our four-year-old daughter, sleeping and totally unaware of all that mess. I looked at her and wondered if her beautiful brown skin and her curly black hair will cause her any trouble in this new country. Did I move her from a country that would attempt to crush her will, independence, and free thought to a country that would judge her as an outsider, as an alien, as a threat? So, America, I hope you do something about that Trump. Consider this book a warning for what is yet to come. Honestly, I'm running out of places to go, and Canada is too fucking cold. I couldn't help but look back at the past 5 years, the turmoil I have gone through, and ask myself, was it really worth it? The scene might look disturbing and the whole Arab Spring concept might look like it was a failure, a step backward, and an unnecessary disaster. But I don't think I have any regrets. I have had an incredible journey. I went from being a heart surgeon to being the host of the most popular show in the region's history. Our little one-hour weekly show exposed a whole system that was founded on fear and brutal force. I am flattered to see religious figures who were considered holy go after me. I feel tickled that military leaders were shaken to their core over a few cleverly written jokes. I managed to get under the skin of a baseless authority, even if it was just for a little while. In a society that is programmed to say, "Yes, master," I bucked the system and firmly said no, and I said it with a smirk and a wink and a nod. And that pissed the hell out of them. I did that hoping that my daughter will also follow suit. She will not be told what to do. She will grow up, and if she chooses to say no, it will be said without fear of being reprimanded or judged for it. I might not be strong enough to continue to tell jokes against my oppressors right now, but maybe we were not meant to see the result or the victory that we hoped for. Maybe it was for another generation, for our children, for my daughter. I see how my work inspired millions of young people around the Middle East to make their own contributions. With every video, vine, and meme, I see the youth using the internet to challenge the hideous propaganda machine. They are finding ways to make fun of these brutal dictatorships. And in a small way, I feel that my show is still going on. A revolution is not just an event. It is a long process. And the process might start with those young people losing respect for the establishments that controlled and brainwashed their parents through religion and fake nationalism. Those young people are questioning everything. Nothing is off-limit, and nothing is taboo anymore. Questioning in itself is a prequel to a revolution. The fall of the social, religious, and military idols that control the Middle East is already happening. Those idols are losing their most important asset, being respected and being revered. The young generation is not taking this bullshit again. They may rule for a while with fear and brutality, but the respect is long gone. It is just a matter of time. But again, I'm no political analyst, no global thinker, and no credible source of information, and I don't have to be any of those things to recognize that the Middle East still looks pretty messy. So now that I have some distance from my experience there and can put things into perspective, I can't help but wonder, was there ever any chance for the revolution to succeed? I mean, I still think it was worth it, but was there any hope at all? And I found that the best way I can answer this question is through physics. If you are familiar with quantum physics, you might have heard of Schrödinger's cat. This is a thought experiment in which a cat is placed in a metal box with a radioactive material and a capsule of poisonous gas. If the radioactive material decays, this will lead to the release of lethal gas that will kill the cat. But until you open the box, your knowledge of the cat's fate is inconclusive. It could be dead, alive, or some other outcome your consciousness has yet to perceive. You won't know until you open the box. This experiment opens the door to the idea of multiple universes with endless possibilities and scenarios, a universe with a live cat and a universe with a dead cat. In our case, we could have had multiple scenarios, depending on power shifts and the intended or unintended consequences of each action. There could have been a multitude of universes with unlimited outcomes different from the one we are living in now. But I can firmly state that in all the possible outcomes for our universe, the one remaining constant is that the Arab world will always be fucked. This is Bassem Youssef. This production of Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring, was directed by Cassandra DeCure and recorded at Skyboat Media in Van Nuys, California. It was produced by Skyboat Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2017 by Bassem Youssef. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.